Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Whose Language is English? By Jian Kerr. Narrated by Hannah Choi. Opening words. At the peak of the British Empire in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, James Murray, the primary editor of the Oxford English Dictionary, raised the question of the very identity of the English language. The English language is the language of Englishmen. Of which Englishmen? Of all Englishmen or of some Englishmen? Does it include the English of Great Britain and the English of America, the English of Australia and of South Africa, and of those most assertive Englishmen, the Englishmen of India, who live in bungalows, hunt in jungles, wear Torai hats or puggarees and pajamas, write chits instead of letters, and eat kedgeree and chutney? Yes, in its most comprehensive sense, and as an object of historical study, it includes all these. They are all forms of English. English as a language has absorbed words from all over the world. Even such common pantry items as eggs, tomatoes, bacon, and ketchup are instances of this absorption. Tea, to make an iconic example, has come to symbolize British national identity and culture, in spite of its origins being far from British. Words have complex trajectories. English has many French words, but the origin of most of these words cannot be said to be purely French. They are words that have moved into French from somewhere else, and then into English. Take the word sugar, for example. According to the Oxford English Dictionary, it is derived from the Old French sucre, 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 and sucre, and ultimately from the medieval Latin zuccherum or succorum, which likely came from the Arabic sukkar. Even the word alphabet is a combination of two Greek words. The linguistic diversity in the English language is perhaps analogous to the diversity of our continually globalizing society. As President John F. Kennedy said, "Everywhere immigrants have enriched and strengthened the fabric of American life." So too have words enriched our language. How do we define American? How do we define English? Over the past 15 years, the percentage of students in schools in the United Kingdom whose first language is not English has more than doubled. In 2008, 7.8% of pupils spoke English as an additional language in the United Kingdom. As of 2021, 19.3% of pupils have been reported to have a first language other than English. More than half of the world's population is estimated to be bilingual, although this is difficult to measure precisely. I have personally been surprised by the number of bilinguals that I encounter in my daily life in the United Kingdom. The pupils at my 12-year-old daughter's small primary school in Oxfordshire speak more than 40 different languages at home. My daughter, who is now in year 7, once told me that there are no real English people in her class, intending to convey to me that none of her classmates were monolingual English speakers. It's an exciting reality where everyone speaks English at her school, yet everyone has a different linguistic and cultural background. We have set ourselves to form a national portrait gallery, not only of the worthies, but of all the members, of the race of English words which is to form the dominant speech of the world. Fling our doors wide. All, not one, but all must enter. For their service, let them be honored. And though the search for them may sometimes seem wearisome, and the labor of the ingathering more irksome still, yet the work is worthy and the aim unselfish. Let us then persevere. This is a quotation from Frederick James Furnival, 1825 through 1910, editor of the Oxford English Dictionary from 1861 to 1870, written in a circular to the members of the Philological Society, dated November 9, 1862. As Furnival points out, English has opened its door to all words of the world. Since then, 160 years have passed, and today English has become the common language of the global population in both the physical and the virtual worlds. Every word has the potential to become an English word, meaning that each word can acquire a second identity and take English as a second home. This book explores words that take English as a second home, a trend that has been developing for centuries and now forms an extremely large collection. The British Empire adopted terms and expressions from inhabitants of the colonies into English. English became a more diverse language as a result, influencing the development of other languages, while simultaneously being influenced and changed by those same languages. Geographical variations of English became more strongly reinforced as the rise of America as the global hegemon after World War II resulted in American English overtaking British English on a global scale. Defining English words is no longer as straightforward as it once was, given that English is spoken by most people in the world. The words discussed in this book are those used in an English context or environment across the world. These words are not limited by regions or registers. If they are used in a linguistic environment where any form of English is dominant, they are within the scope of this book. The development of worldwide English has been, in recent years, catalyzed by social media and technological advancement. In January 2019, 3.484 billion people globally were classified as active social media users. That is around half of the world's population. For many of these people, it is commonplace to use WhatsApp and WeChat in daily life. Together with social media, the emergence of large language models such as ChatGPT and virtual realities has accelerated the process of creating what can be considered supersized English by accelerating word traffic. Making, sharing, and mixing words and ideas in a borderless manner is easier than ever, and meanwhile, the uptake of words is happening at an unprecedented speed. This enormous word pantry allows for once marginalized, forgotten words to be embraced. Social media has brought about word democracy. Ordinary people can participate in the making and sharing of words, tailoring them to their needs. However, it is also possible for corporations to monopolize our word pantry and our understanding and usage of the words in it. Like us, words are in constant motion and difficult to pin down to a singular identity. They are all human-made and carry with them our emotions and history. Some people may view words as nothing more than words, but their significance should not be understated. English in 2024 is vastly different from its previous iterations, constantly evolving and shaped every second by anonymous speakers in both physical and virtual spaces. What will the future of supersized English and the words living in it be? This book explores the new realities of our increasingly expansive English language and the words that call it home. Chapter 1. Who's English? More than one English? Although we often tend to think of English as a monolith, it is more accurate to think of there being many Englishes. Around 75 countries are now using English as their official or first language. The number of people speaking English around the world continues to rise. There are signs that the primary makeup of the English-speaking population is changing. Although the number of English speakers is increasing, the proportion of speakers for whom English is a first language is actually decreasing. In the mid-20th century, nearly 9% of the world's population grew up speaking English as their first language. By 2050, that number is expected to decline to around 5%. This decrease is not the result of population diminution among communities speaking English as their first language, but is rather due to the explosion in popularity as a second language. People who speak languages other than English have the fastest-growing populations, and many of these people are now learning English as a second language. In 2013, the British Council estimated that English was spoken at a useful level by 1.75 billion people worldwide, and that by 2020, the number of people using or learning English would pass 2 billion. In other words, more people than ever before speak English as an additional language. As more people learn English as a second language, the growing number of diverse English-speaking communities around the globe will challenge the idea of who owns the English language. Just as migration led to divergence between the Englishes spoken by British and American speakers, so too should we expect differences between the Englishes spoken as a second language in newer communities of English speakers. Technology and social media may also have an impact. Because of social media, interactions between speakers of different varieties of English are more common than ever, and future technologies will increase our global connectivity even more. There is also the possibility of the development of an international standard English that is not recognizably British, American, or anything else, and will come to be used for communication between different global communities. In addition to a variety of standard English people will learn in school. Even in countries where English is traditionally seen as the main spoken language, such as the United Kingdom and the United States, linguistic landscapes are becoming more diverse. In 2016, the American Community Survey revealed that native speakers of languages other than English make up about 20% of the U.S. population. Over the past 20 years, the percentage of students in UK schools whose first language is not English has almost doubled. In 2002, 10% of pupils spoke English as an additional language. As of 2021, 19.3% of pupils have been reported to have a first language other than English. When people today think of languages, many imagine groups of monolingual speakers neatly arranged into distinct communities divided by national borders. This is an oversimplification. Languages do not necessarily heed nation-state borders, and language maps are highly diverse. The common assumption about languages is likely to become more inaccurate as global connectivity increases. Indeed, a new world order in languages will accompany the next stage of global development. One framework, albeit far from perfect, that has been proposed for making sense of the multiplicity of English speakers across the world is the linguist Braj Khatru's typology of world Englishes. In 1986, Khatru proposed that world English speakers belonged to three concentric circles: an inner circle of countries where English is used as a primary language, such as the United States, the United Kingdom, Australia, New Zealand, and Canada; an outer circle of countries where the use of English is a legacy of colonialism and often has some official status, such as India, Nigeria, the Philippines, and Singapore; and an expanding circle of countries where English is spoken but has no historical or official status, as in South Korea, Sweden, and Saudi Arabia. This model is now outdated, but it can still provide a useful basis on which to consider English in this world. The growing number of speakers of English as a second language, as well as bilingual speakers, inevitably leads us to question what it means to be an English speaker in the 21st century. Although English is increasingly being adopted as a lingua franca, this does not mean that other languages are in danger of being absorbed into or replaced by English. English sits alongside local languages rather than replacing them. It becomes a secondary language rather than a primary one. Globalization, coupled with greater physical and virtual mobility, has actually contributed to making all languages more visible than ever, including endangered languages. English for everyone. When my 12-year-old daughter Sarah introduces herself, she says, My mom is Korean. My dad is half Danish, a quarter Scottish, and a quarter English, which makes me half Korean, a quarter Danish, an eighth Scottish, and an eighth English. My husband is English, but his family history is equally complex. His father's grandparents were from Denmark. His grandmother was born and raised in Shanghai, and his mother was Scottish. It's not just us. Most people's family histories are complex and diverse. My friend Irene, for instance, is from Catalonia, and my friend Theo is from Denmark, but both moved to England. Because of this, their son Luke can speak Danish and Catalan, although he speaks mainly English when he goes to nursery. Their family speaks more than three languages daily, but they mainly use English. Because of the family's history, their version of English is a little bit different from ours, as they mix Spanish, Catalan, and Danish words into their English. Two of our other friends, Henry and Tess, are from Hungary and the Philippines, respectively. Tess's family is originally from the Philippines, but they moved to Los Angeles when Tess was a young girl. She then moved to the United Kingdom. Henry used to live in Budapest and speaks Hungarian and English, while Tess speaks English with a bit of Tagalog. Their son Lorenzo speaks English in nursery, but he can also speak and understand a bit of Tagalog and Hungarian, which he uses when visiting his grandparents. For my friends, English is the language that binds everyone in the family together, but it is not necessarily the language that each member, particularly the parents, finds the most comfortable or familiar. Families like these exist all over the globe. Just like us, English is full of words from different places. At the end of March 2023, my younger daughter Jessie had a birthday party. Her friends come from various cultural backgrounds. Emma is Japanese, Fee is Welsh, Olivia is Irish, Lilia is Moroccan, Rosa is Serbian, Valentine is French, and Jessie is of Korean and Danish heritage. During the party, they all spoke in English, though they occasionally used words from their parents' languages. Despite their diverse backgrounds, all of them are fluent English speakers, or more precisely, second or third generation diaspora English speakers. How do we define an English speaker? Do I belong to the English-speaking populace? These are questions that arise when we discuss the complexities of language and identity. What about the following people? I mainly speak English in my everyday life, but at home I speak a mix of Korean and English with my kids. English is not my first language. I only learned it when I was 13 years old, but I've lived in the UK for 20 years now. Although I still make grammatical mistakes and don't sound like those born in Britain and who speak only English, I still speak more English than Korean in my day-to-day life. Am I eligible to be called an English speaker? I am German with Indian heritage. I live in Germany, but I use English a lot for work in order to collaborate with international colleagues. My English is fluent. I don't have a particular British or American English accent, but I have no problem working in English. I live in Beijing, China. I speak in Mandarin all the time and would say that my English is not very good. However, I use English to communicate on social media or WeChat with my friends in other parts of the world. Their English isn't good either, but English is our common language. These quotations have all been sourced from my personal communications. Although these people's place of birth, home country, native language, learned languages, and English proficiency are all different, they are all legitimate English speakers. One can be considered an English speaker if one uses English, regardless of any of these other characteristics. And this is especially true online, where users can often interact totally anonymously if they choose to. There are now a huge number of varieties of English, each resembling or departing from other varieties in various ways. People across the world use a variety of common Englishes alongside their local regional languages. In social media spaces, English words belonging to global Englishes are made even livelier and more diverse through internet-mediated features, such as memes and emojis. Despite all of this, many of our ideas of what makes an English speaker are stuck in the past. Why should we judge the many varieties of English spoken around the world against the standards set by British or American speakers? A paradigm shift is necessary so that we view English as a language belonging to everyone. Not speaking English in the modern world can be disabling, sometimes even limiting one's ability to navigate everyday life. One example of this is how an individual's intelligence and ability are often judged based on their proficiency in English. Many newcomers to the United Kingdom from Syria have been criticized in the media for their lack of English competence. Under David Cameron's government, gaining citizenship was made stricter and required a higher level of English proficiency. Simultaneously, huge cuts to the funding of English as a foreign language education were made, leaving many feeling ostracized. Not being able to speak English became a limiting factor in the lives of many Syrian newcomers, no matter how qualified they were in their professions. The whole experience can be depressing and isolating. In my personal experience in academia, I have seen people look down on a scholar's academic paper because their English skills were not up to standard. Often, Asian scholars with great minds are undermined and overlooked because of their English ability. Perhaps we need to rethink the nature of English to make it more welcoming, which may be possible soon, thanks to the arrival of generative AI like ChatGPT or Google's Bard. For English to maintain its status as the world's common language, we might begin to acknowledge that all varieties of English are languages in their own right when they are used by a community of speakers. They possess equal legitimacy as standard varieties. Wherever you are born, wherever you live, whatever your official nationality, and whatever your competence in a language, if a meaningful portion of your life is communicated through a form of English, then I argue that you should be considered an English speaker. Rather than constantly trying to smooth our varieties of English into the type of English that is accepted in the United Kingdom or the United States, we should accept all the diversity that the English language has to offer us. We should also be aiming to make English more accessible to everyone around the world. English is a capital asset, and it should be distributed fairly around the globe. I am currently working on a new initiative called English for Everyone. It aims to combat the education bias around the world by providing local teachers with resources for English teaching, thus giving children, particularly those from the Global South, refugees, and those without learning resources, the opportunity to learn a useful skill. English, a second home to the world's words. As a lexicographer working at the peak of the explosion of new words in the early 20th century, James Murray struggled with the question of how best to classify words that had entered English from other languages. Were they English words or not? On what grounds? Like Furnival and most editors of the Oxford English Dictionary, OED, in principle he held an all-welcome view. Despite this, he often described foreign words as uncommon and referred to them as aliens and denizens within the English language. There has been a significant shift since then. In the 21st century, we need to confront whether foreign-born words are still at the margin. English has emerged as the language where words from diverse corners of the world can find a home. It has become a sanctuary for words from different cultures and languages. It's difficult to imagine English without words from other places. As people travel more, the words they carry with them spread far and wide. The pandemic has not stopped this process. In fact, as we continue to interact and communicate with one another, the exchange of words will only increase. It is no longer pertinent to classify certain words as foreign, just as it is difficult to define what it means to be a foreigner. The OED defines foreign as pertaining to countries other than one's own and related senses, but it is unsuitable to use this to describe us and words that are in constant flux. Much like defining the identities of individuals, defining the identity of words can be a difficult task. Singular terms may not capture the full complexity of their origins, meanings, and uses. Words from other languages can be challenging to define and often carry a sense of otherness. Terms such as foreign words, borrowing, and loan words may not always be neutral, much like the word foreigner. That said, I have previously argued that the terms loan or borrowing for foreign words are outdated and no longer accurately describe the dynamic, cross-linguistic, and cultural interactions that occur between words of different heritages. Such classifications may even be considered discriminatory in today's interconnected world. Instead, I propose the term translingual words to describe words that belong to multiple languages at once as a result of word migration. Because of their simultaneous existence in multiple languages, it is difficult to define translingual words as belonging more to one language than another, giving them complex, multicultural identities. These words do not lose their original meanings when they are adopted into another language, but rather exist at the boundary between two or more cultures and languages, taking on diverse nuances in meaning and enriching the lexicon of multiple languages all at once. In Japanese, for instance, the character for sake can refer to any alcoholic drink, hence red wine is sake too. To many of us in the West, however, sake means a Japanese fermented liquor made from rice, as the OED has it. In a similar way, kimono is used in Japan to refer to any kind of garment. In the West, we associate the word with the traditional Japanese dress. Translingual words are ubiquitous in our lives. The most well-known and widely adopted examples are perhaps not words in alphabetical form, but a set of 10 numeral symbols, commonly referred to as Hindu-Arabic numerals. 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9. With the rise of emojis and memes online, we are now seeing the emergence of translingual and transcultural words that, by definition, cannot be attributed to a single nation-state identity. In this book, I use terms such as new words or immigrated words, more precisely, transmigrating words, or other more appropriate language when discussing words from other languages to avoid unnecessary discrimination or stigma. In principle, words of our time are not confined by language borders. The English language is now filled with words that have made English their second or third home, whether they have foreign origins or overseas heritage, much like the diversity present in the population itself. Indeed, English, as we know it, is changing, and so are its users. Over the 20th century, English has spread across the globe, becoming a shared language for billions. Consequently, English continues to go through a process of metamorphosis. The larger English becomes, the less it retains what previously constituted its Englishness. Forms and meanings will be added as the words move back and forth, crossing the boundaries of languages and cultures. In other words, as English is used more widely around the globe, the pantry of English words will be filled with words from all over the world, making it look different from the English that we used to know. Words that we explore in this book are from all around the world, with roots from languages of Asia, Europe, Africa, Oceania, and South America. Some words are visibly hybrid, wearing their immigration life trajectories as part of their appearance. Others are born on social media, so their linguistic heritage is not clear. Every word that we will encounter is a word that has a home in English. However, entering English is not a straightforward process for any word. First of all, a word has to receive its Anglo-Romanization, unless it is an emoji or a meme. Its singular and plural forms must also be decided. It's worth noting that in many Asian languages, singular and plural forms of nouns are determined by the context in which they are used, rather than by inflections or other grammatical markers. European languages, on the other hand, are known for their rich inflectional systems, although they are not as prevalent in English. When translating Asian novels into English, publishers and editors often require that translators anglicize Asian terms as much as possible. Asian people rarely use first names, for example, but in a translation of an Asian novel, you will see the frequent use of first names in direct speech.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?